content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 17th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. GOP pressures Trump to end attacks on judge. What happened? Donald Trump threw the Republican Party into panic turmoil this week after the party's presumptive presidential nominee claimed that the judge overseeing a lawsuit against Trump University was biased because of his Mexican heritage, a comment chagrined Republican leaders denounced as racist. Trump said his plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border created a conflict of interest for U.S. District Judge Gonzalo Curiel, who last week unsealed a trove of documents in a fraud case brought by former students of the billionaire's defunct real estate seminar business. Trump said Curiel was very hostile because he's a Mexican and should be looked into. Curiel, a former federal prosecutor who faced death threats from Mexican drug cartels, is in fact an American citizen born in Indiana to parents who immigrated from Mexico. Trump's attack on Curiel drew sharp criticism from many Republicans and deepened fears that his erratic behavior and caustic language would cost GOP House and Senate candidates their seats. House Speaker Paul Ryan, who waited until last week to endorse Trump, called Trump's Mexican remark the textbook definition of a racist comment, but did not withdraw his support. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he couldn't disagree more with Trump, while former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, rumored to be a possible Trump vice presidential pick, called the remarks inexcusable. Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois rescinded his pledge to support the candidate, while Senator Lindsey Graham described Trump's comments as the most un-American thing from a politician since Joe McCarthy. Trump initially tripled down on his remarks and indicated that Muslim and female judges might have similar conflicts of interest in cases involving him. In comments leaked from within his campaign, he also angrily overruled stupid aides and ordered his surrogates to continue attacking Curiel. But after allies and party leaders implored him to back down, Trump softened his tone. He released a statement saying his remarks had been misconstrued and delivered a subdued victory speech from a teleprompter after Tuesday's Republican primaries, promising to turn his guns on presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton next week. "I understand the responsibility of carrying the mantle," he told supporters. "I will never let you down." What the editorial said. Once again, Trump has steered his pirate ship into uncharted waters, said the New York Times. His insistence that Curiel should be removed from a Trump University case because of his Mexican heritage is patently ridiculous. Since Trump has insulted so many ethnic, racial, and demographic groups, his bizarre logic would mean that there'd be virtually no person in the land left to judge him. Ryan, McConnell, and other reluctant Trump supporters deserve to squirm, said the Chicago Tribune. Ultimately, they either think racism is disqualifying for the job of president, or they don't. Trying to disavow racist comments while affirming your support for the person who makes them is an impossible straddle. After this campaign, they will need a long shower to scrub off the stench of Trump. Trump's belated climb down on judge was a welcome development, said the Wall Street Journal. No Republican thought Trump would change his personality, but they did expect him to adopt the methods necessary to win a modern election. Instead, he's still relying on his own gut and refusing to expand and professionalize his campaign team or raise funds for ads and voter analysis efforts. If Trump doesn't start to act like a political leader and his poll numbers go south, he may start to hear rumblings that delegates are looking for someone else to nominate. What the columnist said, Trump's comments on Curiel were really a dumber version of arguments put forward on the left for years, said Timothy Carney in the Washington Examiner. Many liberals wrongly believe that white people don't have the right or ability to express opinions on certain issues involving race. Trump, the candidate of white racial grievance, has adopted that logic and turned it around. Sorry, but Trump didn't attack Curiel as part of some clever political strategy, said Noah Millman in TheWeek.com. Trump was ranting about Curiel because he knows he is going to lose the Trump University case. Like so many of his supporters, Trump sees himself as a winner, and when faced with evidence that he's been running a big con, he lashes out in blind, heedless fury. The Republican Party has made the bed it now lies in, said Ron Fournier in TheAtlantic.com. Party Chairman Rince Priebus and leaders like Ryan will try to distance themselves from Trump's abhorrent views of Hispanics, Muslims, and women, but they knowingly backed an intolerant narcissist. By falling into line behind an undisguised bigot, Republican leaders have in fact proved his central point, said Eli Lake in BloombergView.com. That politicians are a bunch of frauds who'll say or do anything to remain in power. Can Republican leaders still be in denial, asked Josh Barrow in BusinessInsider.com. They keep telling themselves that if Trump is handed power and responsibility, he might turn into a reasonable person. But Trump has always been crass, mercurial, and dishonest, with the temperament of an impetuous child. He is not going to evolve, not during the campaign, and not if he becomes president. Anyone who thinks otherwise is engaging in pathetic self-deception. And a second main story this week. Clinton claims historic victory as Sanders battles on. What happened? Hillary Clinton made history this week by becoming the first woman to clinch the presidential nomination of a major U.S. political party, even as Democratic rival Senator Bernie Sanders doggedly vowed to fight on to the next month's party convention in Philadelphia. Clinton won four of this week's six nominating contests, crushing Sanders 63% to 37% in New Jersey and capturing delegate-rich California 56-43, despite a fierce challenge by the Vermont senator. She also triumphed in New Mexico and South Dakota, while Sanders prevailed in Montana and North Dakota. The results pushed Clinton's delegate count to 2,777, including superdelegates, party leaders who are free to vote for any candidate, well beyond the 2,383 needed for the nomination. Sanders has won 1,864 delegates, including superdelegates. At a Brooklyn rally, Clinton basked in her historic achievement. Tonight's victory, she told jubilant supporters, belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible. Pivoting to Trump, Clinton called the billionaire temperamentally unfit to be president. Clinton also saluted her Democratic opponent, whose fiery cries for a political revolution have galvanized progressives and young voters. Sanders, though, promised to keep battling for every vote and every delegate until next month's convention, where the real tussle is expected to be over the party's platform. Sanders is pushing hard for the party to back a government-run, single-payer health care system, which Clinton has called politically impossible. He also wants to reduce the power that superdelegates have in the nominating process and could try to soften the party's support of Israel. Two Sanders appointees to the platform drafting committee, Cornel West and James Zogby, are sharply critical of Israel's treatment of Palestinians. Clinton is likely to balk at any language that might alienate U.S. supporters of Israel or move her campaign sharply to the left. What the editorial said. Sanders and his supporters need to face facts, said the Los Angeles Times. They lost, and not because the system was rigged by Clinton's favor. And as they often claim, she outperformed Sanders in total votes cast, states won, and pledged delegates earned. He has been a formidable contender, but it is the former Secretary of State who will oppose the intemperate, intolerant, and ill-informed Trump. Sanders can provide valuable assistance by asking his young supporters to rally around Clinton and should start doing so now. The senator should read the writing on the wall, said the Boston Globe, but the party also needs to recognize his achievement. The self-declared democratic socialist made a different kind of history than Clinton, running a grassroots campaign that far outperformed expectations and nudged Clinton left on economic issues. The party should reward him with a prime speaking spot at the convention to broadcast his ideas to the widest audience. What the columnist said. Admit it. Clinton is an extraordinarily talented politician, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. She has long been dismissed as an inept, flawed candidate and has admitted that she doesn't have the oratorical flair of her husband or President Obama. But Clinton has mastered a more traditionally female approach to leadership, creating coalitions, finding common ground, winning over allies. It's an unglamorous grind that requires an emotional toughness most human beings can't summon. Clinton worked hard for her win, but don't expect any gracious expressions of defeat from Sanders, said Michael Barbaro in New York Times. On Clinton's big night, he bragged and vowed to fight on at a Santa Monica, California rally. When the crowd loudly booed a mention of Clinton and chanted Bernie or bust, the Vermont senator did little to discourage them. Sanders still considers himself a revolutionary, opposed to the establishment Clinton represents. Party unity, it seems, is the furthest thing from his mind. Sanders doesn't have to drop out right away, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. He could wait until after next week's final primary in Washington, D.C. In fact, he owes it to the small donors who contributed $200 million to his campaign to fight to the end. But if Sanders then plays it nasty by trying to sway superdelegates to his side because he polls better against Trump that particular day, he won't just come off as a heel. He will fail spectacularly, endangering both his legacy and Clinton's chances in November. Our controversy of the week is titled Ali, Why He Was So Widely Revered and Hated. And because of that, we're going to take a slight detour and first read his obituary and then come back to the controversy of the week. The heavyweight champion who shook up the world, Muhammad Ali, 1942 to 2016. When Nelson Mandela was inaugurated as South Africa's first black president in 1994, a guest suggested that he and Muhammad Ali were the two most revered figures in the world. The anti-apartheid icon demurred. If I was in a crowded room with Ali, I would stop what I was doing and go up to him, Mandela said. He is the greatest. That was the nickname Ali gave himself, and few disagreed. Singularly magnetic and outrageously handsome, the three-time heavyweight boxing champion dazzled in the ring. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, he'd say, dancing his trademark Ali shuffle, bobbing, fainting, trash-talking, punching ferociously. Outside the ring, he battled against the racial status quo, and his refusal to be drafted during the Vietnam War, his defiant black pride, and his rejection of his slave name, Cassius Clay, made him a lightning rod in the 1960s and 70s. But in later life, he was regarded with almost universal affection, praised for his activism and humanitarian work, and his long, gallant struggle with Parkinson's disease. I wish people would love everybody else the way they love me, Ali said. It would be a better world. He was born Cassius Marcellus Clay, Jr., in segregated Louisville, said the New York Times. His mother, Odessa, was a house cleaner and cook. His father, Cassius Sr., was a sign painter and church muralist who blamed discrimination for his failure to become a recognized artist. Violent and often drunk, he lectured his children on the teachings of black separatist Marcus Garvey. Ali's racial identity was also shaped by the 1955 murder of Emmett Till, a black 14-year-old shot and mutilated in Mississippi for allegedly whistling at a white woman. Photographs of Till's brutalized face in the black press showed Ali the limits of the possibilities as a black kid in the South, said the New Yorker. His ticket out was boxing, which he took up at 12 to avenge the indignity of a stolen bicycle. He reported the theft to Joe Martin, a white police officer and gym owner. When young Ali promised to beat up the thief, Martin suggested he first learn how to throw a punch. Ali flung himself into training and would sometimes race the school bus for 20 blocks and always claim to beat it, said Time. He was precociously confident, shouting that he was the greatest during his school bus races and using verse to taunt his boxing opponents. This guy must be done. I'll stop him in one. Ali won 100 of 108 amateur fights and qualified for the 1960 Rome Olympics, ultimately winning a gold medal in the 178-pound light heavyweight division. The charismatic teen strutted around the Olympic Village, where he was known as the mayor, and was greeted as a hero when he arrived back in Louisville, although his gold medal could not get him a glass of juice at the Jim Crow luncheonette. He turned professional with the backing of 11 local white businessmen. They got the complexions and connections to give me good directions, he said, and began working with his lifelong trainer, Angelo Dundee. In the ring, Ali had an almost casual style, lightly bouncing on his feet while keeping his hands low at his side, said the Washington Post. Some sports writers considered it an almost suicidal approach. But his constant movement and unconventional stance made Ali hard to hit, and his punches arrived from unexpected angles, carrying devastating power. He mowed down a string of opponents, setting up a 1964 title fight against Sonny Liston, a glowering ex-convict. Ali, 6'3" and 210 pounds, mocked Liston as a big, ugly bear and taunted him in rhyme. Yes, the crowd did not dream when they put up their money that they would see the total eclipse of the Sonny. As promised, Ali pummeled his heavily favored foe, who refused to answer the bell for the seventh round. I am the greatest, the new champ cried. I shook up the world. In their rematch a year later, he would KO Liston in the first round. By then, Cassius Clay had become Muhammad Ali and was a member of the Nation of Islam, an African-American religious group which championed racial separation, said the Los Angeles Times. His public support for the group created a rift in his family and polarized fans. Still more divisive was his refusal to be drafted to fight in Vietnam, which led sports writers and politicians to denounce him as a traitor. Man, I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong, he said. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison for the draft evasion in 1967 and had his championship and boxing license taken away. Ali remained free as he appealed the verdict, which was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1971, but lost 3.5 years of his boxing prime. Still, some of the best and most brutal fights lay ahead. His comeback included two epic fights with Joe Frazier and continued with 1974's Rumble in the Jungle, a face-off against the younger, more powerful heavyweight champion George Foreman in Zaire. During the fight, Ali used his new rope-a-dope tactic, in which he backed into the ropes, protecting his face with his arms, and the hard-punching Foreman wore himself out. In the eighth round, Ali delivered a blow that sent Foreman spinning round and down into the canvas. A year later came the Thriller in Manila, the third and final showdown between Ali and Frazier. A savage grudge match that ended when Frazier's swollen face forced him to quit after the 14th round. A battered Ali called the fight the closest thing to dying that he ever experienced. Urged to quit the ring to protect his health, Ali refused, said the Boston Globe. But age finally caught up to him, and in 1978 he lost the title to Leon Spinks, a fighter 12 years his junior. Ali reclaimed the championship in a rematch, but lost two more bouts and quit for good in 1981. 3 years later, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, quite possibly because of blows sustained in the ring. Yet he traveled tirelessly on humanitarian missions. But as the degenerative disease robbed him of the verbal and physical agility that had arguably made him more famous than anyone on earth, Ali kept an increasingly low profile. He occasionally emerged, raising a trembling arm to light the Olympic flame during the 1996 Atlantic Games and receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005. Throughout, Ali accepted his illness with grace and humility. "I know why this has happened," he said. "God's showing me that I'm just a man like everybody else." And now we'll circle back to that controversy of the week. Ali, why was he so widely revered and hated? Love him or hate him, Muhammad Ali, who died last week at 74, was the most important athlete to ever live, said David Zirin in TheNation.com. The talent and brash charisma he displayed in and out of the boxing ring made him a global superstar. But what elevated Ali to world historical status was his insistence on speaking truth to power, no matter the cost. After becoming heavyweight champion in 1964, Ali shocked white America when he dropped his slave name of Cassius Clay, joined the Nation of Islam, and started speaking out against racism. 3 years later, at the peak of his career, Ali publicly refused to register for the Vietnam draft. Why, Ali asked, should he go 10,000 miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? His stand as a conscientious objector got Ali banned from boxing for nearly 4 years and cost him millions, but it galvanized the anti-war movement and inspired black Americans to fight for their rights. The great paradox of Ali is that he became famous for his awesome talent for violence, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com. But his greatest achievement was refusing to fight in an unjust war. R.I.P. The saintly Ali is a cultural fiction, said David Marcus in TheFederalist.com. The black Muslim movement he joined was radical and racist and opposed both women's equality and racial integration. A black man should be killed if he's messing around with a white woman, he said soon after his conversion. No intelligent person wants to mix races. He could be needlessly cruel, humiliating wives with public affairs and mocking black opponents, particularly the dignified Joe Frazier, as Uncle Tom's. Ali was a complicated figure and not always admirable, said Peter Winner in CommentaryMagazine.com. But over time, some of those rougher edges were sanded off. And as he grew frail, the militant side of him eventually gave way to greater gentleness and a desire for reconciliation among people of all races. The young Ali's refusal to play nice changed everything for black Americans, said Jillian White in The Atlantic. In the Jim Crow era, men like my father were supposed to apologize and accommodate, to simply keep their heads down and do it as they were told. Those rules governed my grandfather's life. But Ali proved that there was another way and directly inspired my father to push for a life bigger than the one that had been imagined for him. He left his segregated hometown and went to a prestigious East Coast college, having seen it was possible to be both black and excellent. Still, in many ways, Ali was a tragic figure, said Stephen Carter in BloombergView.com. His anti-war stance robbed him and us of his prime boxing years. When the Supreme Court unanimously restored his license in 1971, he wasn't the same sublime fighter. Pride and the need for money kept him boxing into the 1980s, and the countless blows he absorbed over the years surely contributed to his developing Parkinson's disease when he was just 42. With grace and good humor, Ali spent the rest of his life proving that it is possible to stand undaunted in the encroaching shadow of disability and death. Ali's three-decade twilight as a pummeled god may have been his greatest gift to us, said Gerald Early in the Washington Post. We should all wear our scars with such glorious indifference to the cost of doing life's business. Now, time for our good week, bad week shorts. Apparently, it was a good week for selling sex. After a, quote, do it for mom ad campaign urging Danes to make more babies apparently helped spark a 14% boom in the country's birth rate this summer. It's definitely a feather in our cap, said one proud Danish official. It was a good week for homecomings after a Canadian vegan purchased a live lobster at a local supermarket and had it shipped 2,000 miles so that it could be released into its native waters off Nova Scotia. I hope he'll live 70 years, said Christine Lawfed, and outlive all of us. And it was a good week for mustard after the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council declared that ketchup is unfit for hot dogs and should be used as a condiment only for people under the age of 18. But it was a bad week for seeing Hamilton after reports that the Broadway show's creator, Lin-Manuel Miranda, is leaving the show in July caused already sky-high ticket prices to more than double. The cheapest seat on the resale website StubHub spiked to over $1,500, while seats in the orchestra topped $10,000. It was a bad week for butterflies after an overexcited So You Think You Can Dance contestant vomited on host Paula Abdul. After earning a trip to the show's next round, 12-year-old Chi Tahini said that when Abdul hugged her, all the happiness came out on her jacket. And it was a bad week for image control after Guns N' Roses frontman Axl Rose reportedly demanded that Google remove an unflattering photo of the now chunky singer. The image has sparked an internet meme called Fat Axl with pictures of the rotund Rose accompanied by such mocking captions as Sweet Pie of Mine. We're on the briefing page now. Guantanamo's forever prisoners. President Obama came into office vowing to close the notorious prison at Guantanamo Bay. Why didn't he succeed? How many prisoners are left? There are still 80 enemy combatants being held at Guantanamo Bay Military Detention Center at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. That's down from a total of 779 inmates imprisoned there since the Bush administration created the detention center as part of the War on Terror in January 2002. When President Obama took office in 2009, 242 inmates remained, most of whom hadn't been charged with a crime. Days later, he signed an executive order requiring Guantanamo to be closed within the year. But Obama's efforts to empty the facility and transfer remaining inmates to federal prisons have been stymied by the adamant Republican opposition. Guantanamo correspondent Carol Rosenberg was assigned by the Miami Herald to cover the prison's closure more than 12 years ago. As it stands, says Rosenberg, it could be that we will just be waiting for the last guy to die before it closes. Why does Obama want to close it? The Bush administration purposely sent the detainees to Guantanamo because it represented an island outside of the law, free from U.S. constitutional protections. Obama and other Guantanamo critics believe this indefinite detention of prisoners without trial, some of whom have staged hunger strikes in protest and have been force-fed to keep them alive, represents a stain on America's reputation. Critics also say Guantanamo serves as a propaganda tool for terrorists who claim Muslims have been unjustly persecuted by the West. Osama bin Laden himself called the ugly crimes committed at Guantanamo during the interrogations, and in horrific videos recorded in 2014, ISIS dressed several Western hostages in the prison's distinctive orange jumpsuits before beheading them. Who has left the prison? About 540 inmates were released without charge by Bush. Many of them, it turned out, weren't actually al-Qaeda terrorists, but Afghans and Pakistanis who had been sold to the U.S. for $5,000 per head bounty. The Obama administration has released another 158, sending them to 58 nations, stretching from Latvia to Bermuda. These former detainees are usually held in rehabilitation centers and banned from traveling for at least a year. A major sticking point for people who oppose Guantanamo's closure, however, is that many detainees have returned to terrorist activities after their release. Republican Senator John McCain puts the recidivism rate at 30%, the Obama administration at 17%. Some have been involved in the killing of Americans. Another, a former driver for Osama bin Laden, who was released to Sudan in 2002, has since appeared in an al-Qaeda video calling on jihadists to light up the ground beneath the feet of the crusaders. Who's still there? The most prominent inmate is alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, along with four alleged co-conspirators, is awaiting trial under the military tribunal system set up by Bush. Another 28 inmates, most of them from Yemen, have been cleared for release. But the Obama administration doesn't want to send them home because Yemen remains a hotbed of al-Qaeda activity. A final group of about 43 detainees, the so-called forever prisoners, are deemed too dangerous to release but impossible to prosecute because any evidence against them was obtained through waterboarding and other since-prohibited enhanced interrogation techniques and is therefore tainted. Their presence has forced Obama to shift tactics. What is Obama's latest plan? Under a proposal sent to Congress in February, the Obama administration recommends transferring at least 13 forever prisoners north to U.S. facilities, potentially to military prisons in Kansas or South Carolina, or to a federal supermax in Colorado. The proposal could save the Pentagon $140 million a year, but congressional Republicans blocked it and refused to reconsider the legislation they passed in 2015 that forbids the use of federal funds to transfer Guantanamo detainees to U.S. soil. Most of the remaining Guantanamo detainees are the worst of the worst terrorists, said Senator Kelly Ayotte, who contends it's not safe to house them in the U.S. The Obama administration points out that American prisons already hold 443 convicted terrorists with no apparent threat to the public. What else can Obama do? The White House has said it's considering using an executive order to close the prison, though that would require defying the will of Congress and the majority of the American public, according to polls. Even then, Obama's victory would be pretty hollow, says South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who has opposed moving inmates to prisons in her state. America would still be imprisoning accused terrorists indefinitely and without trial, she argues, just on home soil. They will be held under the same legal authority, by the same country, in the same manner, but for the same duration, and for the same reasons. Why does the zip code matter? Time for a few of the columns. We'll take two from Europe this week. The first from the United Kingdom. Will bad branding kill the EU? Bad news for those who want Britain to stay in the EU. Brexit is a really catchy word, said Niamh Gallagher. Britons are voting this month on whether to exit the European Union or remain, and the portmanteaus they have coined to represent the two sides are Brexit and Bremain. Brexit, obviously, has much more punch than Bremain, which sounds like an unusual surname or a brand of medicine. It's not like the Remain camp had much choice, though, as Bray for Britain's stay would have been even worse. Brexit, in fact, is so successful that even the Remain side has begun to frame its campaign as saying no to Brexit. That's already a victory for the Leave camp, because by talking about Brexit, we are subconsciously prepared for a British exit. Brits have been swayed by slogans before and recently. Many of them supported the idea of cutting the benefits of public housing residents who had a spare bedroom in their subsidized homes, since that extra bedroom could always be rented out. But then the Labour Party started referring to the so-called under-occupancy penalty as a bedroom tax, and many people changed their minds. Bedroom tax just sounded mean. Similarly, Brexit sounds jaunty and plucky, while Bremain just sits there in the mind. The UK could well leave the Union because of the power of a pithy slogan. This one from Germany. Xenophobic party shows its racism. The anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party has finally admitted that it just doesn't like black people, said Sebastian Fischer. The party's deputy head, Alexander Gauland, let the unpleasant truth slip last week. Speaking of Jerome Boateng, a star defender on the German national soccer team, Gauland mused, "People like him as a soccer player, but they wouldn't want Boateng as a neighbor. Why, one wonders? Boateng is quite wealthy. Surely he would keep his lawn neatly mowed." It goes without saying that Gauland was referencing Boateng's dark skin. It's a malicious, insidious statement. Boateng is a native German, born in Berlin to a white mother and a Ghanaian father. But in Gauland's eyes, while it's okay for Boateng to represent Germany on the soccer field, he shouldn't live next door to white Germans. Gauland tried to walk back his nasty comment, of course, claiming that he was not racist, but merely speaking of what some people might feel. This rhetorical gimmick is a classic tactic of his far-right party, but the rest of us aren't fooled. As for me, I think it would be fine for Gauland to live next door to me, despite his odious attitudes. But I don't want him representing Germany in the political field. And this column from Israel, U.S. aid benefits America, too. Let's dispense with the fiction that U.S. gives Israel military assistance as some kind of aid or charity, said Netanel Reich. Some Israelis act as if we were a supplicant, a tramp rattling the gates to the mansion, asking for largesse. In truth, the security relationship with Israel is worth far more to the Americans than the $3 billion a year they send. Former Secretary of State Al Haig once said Israel was America's unsinkable aircraft carrier because the U.S. can use Israel as a frontline platform for its military. Israel hosts the U.S. radar station in the Negev, which generates some $500 million worth of data. Americans also get access to Israeli projects like the anti-missile system Iron Dome, allowing the U.S. to benefit from any new Israeli technology without any of the development risks, a value of perhaps $1.5 billion a year. Military intelligence that Israel shares with the U.S. is worth at least another $1.5 billion, and probably more. And finally, let's remember that the aid doesn't come in cash, but rather in the form of discounts on U.S.-made weaponry, which mean Israel gets to bankroll thousands of American jobs. This isn't aid. It's a security pact in which both sides contribute and both benefit. And on to the last word, growing up in the screen age. What's it like to be 13 years old and glued to a smartphone and laptop all day, measuring your worth in likes, comments, and notifications? Journalist Jessica Contrera takes us inside one girl's world. She slides into the car, and even before she buckles her seatbelt, her phone is alight in her hands. A 13-year-old girl after a day of eighth grade. She says hello. Her au pair asks, "Ready to go?" She doesn't respond, her thumb on Instagram. A Barbara Walters meme is on the screen. She scrolls, and another meme appears. Then another meme, and she closes the app. She opens BuzzFeed. There's a story about Florida Governor Rick Scott, which she scrolls past to get to a story about Janet Jackson, then 28 things you'll understand if you're both British and American. She closes it. She opens Instagram. She opens the NBA app. She shuts the screen off. She turns it back on. She opens Spotify, opens Firebit. She has 7,427 steps. Opens Instagram again, opens Snapchat. She watches a sparkly rainbow flow from her friend's mouth. She watches a YouTube star make a pouty faces at the camera. She watches a tutorial on nail art. She feels the bump of the driveway and looks up. They're home. 12 minutes have passed. Catherine Pomerening's iPhone is the place where all of her friends are always hanging out. So it's the place where she is, too. She's on it after it rings to wake her up in the mornings. She's on it at school when she can sneak it. She's on it while her 8-year-old sister, Lila, is building crafts out of beads. She sets it down to play basketball, to skateboard, to watch PG-13 comedies, and sometimes to eat dinner. But when she picks it back up, she might have 64 unread messages. Now she's on it in the living room of her big house in McLean, Virginia, while she explains what it's like to be a 13-year-old today. Over 100 likes is good for me. And comments. You just comment to make a joke or tag someone. The best thing is the little notification box, which means someone liked, tagged, or followed her on Instagram. She has 604 followers. There are only 25 photos on her page because she deletes most of what she posts. The ones that don't get enough likes, don't have good enough lighting, or don't show the coolest moments in her life must be deleted. Somewhere, maybe at this very moment, neurologists are trying to figure out what all the screen time is doing to still-forming brains of people's Catherine's age. Members of what's known as Generation Z. Educators are trying to teach them that not all answers are Googleable. Counselors are prying them out of internet addictions. Parents are trying to catch up by friending their kids on Facebook. P.S. Facebook is obsolete. Sociologists, advertisers, stock market analysts, everyone wants to know what happens when the generation born glued to screens has to look up and interact with the world. Right now, Catherine is still looking down. "See this girl," she says. "She gets so many likes on her pictures because she's posted over 9 pictures saying, 'Like all my pictures for a TBH,'" comment when done. "So everyone will like her pictures, and she'll just give them a simple TBH. A TBH is a compliment. It stands for to be heard or to be honest. It kind of almost promotes you as a good person," she explains. "If someone says, 'TBH, you're nice and pretty,' that kind of like validates you in the comments. Then people can look at it and say, 'Oh, she's nice and pretty.' TBH, Catherine is both nice and pretty. She has the cheeks of a middle schooler and the vocabulary of a high schooler. She has light brown eyes, which she only paints with makeup for dances where there are boys from other schools. Her family is wealthier than most and has seen more sorrow. She is 5'1", but will have a growth spurt soon," or so said her dad, Dave, in a very awkward talk he had with her about puberty, even after she told him, "Please don't." School is where she thrives. She is beloved by her teachers, will soon star as young Simba in the 8th grade performance of the Lion King musical, and gets straight A's. Her school doesn't offer a math course challenging enough for her, so she takes honors algebra online through Johns Hopkins University. Now she's on her own page, checking the comments beneath a photo of a friend, Aisha, which she posted for Aisha's birthday. "Happy birthday posts are a pretty big deal," she says. "It really shows who cares enough to put you on their page." Her floor is a tangle of clothes, and her bed is a tangle of cords. One for her phone, one for an iPod, one for her school laptop, and one for the laptop that used to belong to her mom, Alicia. A pink blanket with Alicia's name on it lies across her comforter. A black and white photo of her mom on her wedding day sits on her desk. In a frame on her nightstand, handprint art they made together one Mother's Day. The breast cancer appeared right after Catherine was born. It went away, then came back when Catherine was in 3rd grade. In 5th grade, Alicia and Dave bought Catherine a cell phone in case things took a turn. She signed up for Snapchat and Instagram, Twitter and VSCO. She stopped inviting friends to the house because her mom was there, sick. Last year, on a cloudy Thursday in March, Alicia died. Catherine won't talk about it, today or any day. Not talking about it means she doesn't need to think about it, except when the house is quiet and the thinking just seeps in. She doesn't tell her friends how it feels. When she's asked about it, she crumples. Her shoulders hunch, her eyes well, but no tears fall on her cheeks. "Please," she would say if she were reading this, "go back to talking about my phone." Lila can't find her tap shoes. Rachel, the au pair, is sick. The dogs are waiting for breakfast, and Catherine is heading straight for the garage. "Don't you think you should eat something?" her dad asks, rummaging through a cabinet. "A breakfast bar?" Catherine's arms are crossed with her pastel pink phone case in her hand. "I feel like you should eat something before..." "I'm fine," she says. Dave Pomerening wants to figure out how to get Catherine to use her phone less. 1 month, she ate up 18 gigabytes of data. Most large plans max out at 10. He intervened and capped her at 4. "I don't want to crimp it too much," he says. "That's something from my perspective. I'm going to have to figure out how to get my arms around that." He says that a lot. He's a 56-year-old corporate lawyer who doesn't know how to upload photos to his Facebook page. When he was 13, he lived only 2 miles away. He didn't have a cell phone, of course, and home phones were reserved for adults. When he wanted to talk to his friends, he rode his bike to their houses. His parents expected him to play outside all day and be back by dinner time. Some of Catherine's very best friends have never been to her house, or she to theirs. To Dave, it seems like they rarely hang out, but he knows that to her, it seems like they're together all the time. He tries to watch what she sends them, pictures of their family skiing, pictures of their cat, Bo, but he's not sure what her friends, or whoever she follows, are sending back. He checks the phone bill to see who she's called and how much she's been texting, but she barely calls anyone and chats mostly through Snapchat, where her messages disappear. Another dad recommended that Dave use parental controls to stop Catherine from using her phone at night. He put that in place, but it seemed as soon as he did, there was some reason he needed to switch it off. He finds Catherine waiting in the car with two backpacks, one for her books and one for her laptop. "What jacket are you going to wear?" he asks. "I'm going to grab a sweater," she says. She heads back into the house, phone in hand, protecting it from prying eyes. Even if her dad tried snooping around her apps, the true dramas of teenage girl life are not written in the comments, like how sometimes Catherine's friends will borrow her phone just to unlike all the Instagram photos of girls they don't like. Catherine can't go back to those girls' pages and re-like the photos because that would be stalking, which is forbidden. Or how at the middle school dance, her friends got the phone numbers of 10 boys, but then they had to delete 5 of them because they were 7th graders. And before she could add the boys on Snapchat, she realized she had to change her username because it was her childhood nickname, and that was totally embarrassing. Then, because she changed her username, her Snapchat score reverted to 0. The app awards about 1 point for every snap you send and receive. It's also totally embarrassing and stressful to have a low Snapchat score. So in one day, she sent enough snaps to earn 1,000 points. Snapchat is where flirting happens. She doesn't know anyone who has sent a naked picture to a boy, but she knows it happens with older girls who know they have met the right guy. Nothing her dad could find on her phone shows that as good as Catherine is at math, basketball, and singing. She wants to get better at her phone, to be one of the girls who knows what to post, how to caption it, when to like, what to comment. She gets back in the car with a navy blue sweater. One small parenting win for Dave. He needs to figure out what Snapchat is about, and how to be a Washington lawyer and a single parent, and how to get them to eat breakfast and brush their hair and get to school on time. He clicks on the car satellite radio and changes the channel from 60s to 6 to Hits 1, the station he thinks Catherine and Lila like. It's playing Justin Bieber. He pulls out of the driveway and glances over at the passenger seat. Catherine is looking out the window, headphones on. On the morning of her 14th birthday, Catherine wakes up to an alarm on her phone. It's 6:30 a.m. She rolls over and shuts it off in the dark. Her grandparents, here to celebrate the end of her first year of teenagerhood, are sleeping in the guest room down the hall. She can hear the dogs shuffling across the hardwood downstairs, waiting to be fed. Propping herself up on her peace sign-covered pillow, she opens Instagram. Later, Lila will give her a Starbucks gift card. Her dad will bring donuts to her class. Her grandparents will take her to the melting pot for dinner. But first, her friends will decide whether to post pictures of Catherine for her birthday, whether they like her enough to put a picture of her on their page. Those pictures, if they come, will get likes and maybe TBHs. They should be posted in the morning, any minute now. She scrolls past a friend posing in a bikini on the beach, then a picture posted by Kendall Jenner, a selfie with coffee, a basketball vine, a selfie with a girl's tongue out. She scrolls, she waits for that little notification box to appear. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the health and science page, a cell phone cancer connection. A new government study is reigniting the debate over whether cell phones can cause cancer. Researchers at the National Institutes of Health found that male rats exposed to cell phone radiation for 9 hours a day were more likely to develop brain cancers known as gliomas, as well as tumors in the heart called schwannomas. The longer the rats were exposed, the higher their incidence of these rare tumors, NBCNews.com reports. Complete results from the $25 million study won't be available until next year. But with more than 90% of American adults using mobile devices, the researchers decided their initial findings were warranted an early release. "We felt it was important to get the word out," said toxicologist John Butcher. "Overall, we feel that the tumors are likely to be related to exposures." The study, however, produced some conflicting results. Oddly, female rats showed no effects from the radiation, while male rats exposed to radiation actually lived longer than male rats not exposed. Critics argue that research involving rats may not apply to people. Indeed, brain cancer rates in the U.S. have not increased since the 1990s, when cell phones first became widespread. But Butcher said 70 to 80% of experts who reviewed the study concluded cell phone radiation did raise the risk of cancer in the exposed rats. And just time for some short notes here. Global terrorist attacks have decreased for the first time since 2012, dropping 13% from 2014, despite high-profile attacks in Paris and Brussels. Fatality from terrorist incidents decreased 14% over the same period. And let's see, we will finish off today with a quote from Anne Lamott. She says, "Lighthouses don't go running all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there, shining." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.